Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Welcome back, everyone, to FYI, For Your Innovation, ARK Invest's podcast. I have a very special guest with us today, and I will introduce him in a moment. But with me today is our chief investment strategist, Charlie Roberts, who his background is varied, and but who has made it his business over the years to understand and really be a part of making the convergence between multiomics, in the life sciences space, and artificial intelligence. So, ultimately, with the hope of curing disease and diagnosing disease before it actually happens. So, welcome, Charlie. And Peter Diamandis, and actually Charlie and Peter go a long way back. So Peter is the founder, many of you may know, of XPRIZE, the founder of Singularity University. That's how I found Peter years ago. And I just was so inspired by his vision and thought it was so important to educate the world about innovation and how it was going to transform our life. So important that I've taken a leaf from his book, and we're doing our small part in middle schools with ARK's research. And Peter is the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, so look those up. And he is very closely aligned and very close to, I would say, Ray Kurzweil, who helped him found Singularity University, and therefore is getting glimpses into the future by the day, which continue to astonish us. And he's a part of making it all happen. So thank you, Peter, for joining us today.
Of course, Kathy. It's good to be with friends.
Yeah. So, well, we figured we'd talk about some of your favorite subjects. And, you know, I'd love to start with healthcare. Actually, we did a podcast not too long ago, Peter, and we probably didn't spend enough time on that. So, and I know you're passionate about it.
Every day that I get older, I get more and more passionate about it.
Yes, very motivating. And so I'd love to start there. And actually, Charlie, given your very important role in making this world happen, I'd love to hear you two talk about human longevity and what is happening out there that excites you so much about the possibilities, especially around this convergence between and among technologies.
So I differentiate, Kathy and Charlie, between healthcare, because we don't have healthcare today. We have sick care, right? Just to be clear, we take care of people after they're sick, which is a complete reversal of the way it should be. We should have healthcare, which is a series of systems and products and services that keep you healthy versus react to you after you're sick. What I am interested in is health span extension or longevity. And for me, that journey started, you know, decades ago. I was doing a joint MD, PhD program at Harvard Medical School and MIT. I bailed with a master's degree before finishing my PhD. No one was going to call me doctor. That's, by the way, where I was. That's where I was roomies with Mike Saylor. We were in the fraternity together, which was fun. But when I was there, I remember seeing a television show on long-lived sea life, that bowhead whales could live 200 years and Greenland sharks could live 400 or 500 years. And I remember thinking to myself, if they can live that long, why can't we? And I said, it's either a hardware problem or a software problem. And we're going to have the ability to solve that. And I personally believe that this is the decade. And there are four major reasons. I can go into that if you want. But this is the decade where we're going to make a dent in extending the healthy human lifespan, right? I've just launched a $101 million health span X Prize to try and reverse the ravages of aging by 20 years. But there's a lot happening. And it's really AI and quantum and biotech and all these things converging, right? We talk a lot about convergence that is going to give us the ability to understand perhaps why we age, how to slow it, stop it, and perhaps reverse it. And if we can, I would posit it's the biggest financial market on the planet.
Yeah, in terms of opportunities out there.
Right.
Yeah. How far do you think we can push this? What are the limits? And, you know, we might be able to cure all kinds of diseases out there. You know, okay, how do we die? What happens? Just hardware, the hardware.
Yeah. I mean, the way I think about this, there's a couple of things. One, you know, if you cure cancer or heart disease, it only extends the average lifespan some single digit number of years. I wish it was more, but it's not. You intercept some other degenerative diseases. And other thing to realize is the body was never designed to live past age 30. 100,000 years ago, we would be pregnant by age 12 or 13. By the time we were 26, 27, we were a grandparent. And before food was abundant, the last thing you wanted to do was steal food from your grandchildren's mouths. And therefore, you would die, give your bits back, and you pass on the genes. So the question is, what is possible? The longest lived human today on record is 122. I think the longest lived human in the U.S. today is 114. And so people have this mental barrier that we can't get past that. And if we don't do anything, yeah, we're sort of stuck there. But I think that we're beginning to understand the root causes of aging and the ability to interfere. And so that's what I'm heavily investing in, working on. And for me, it's my biggest moonshot right now. Space was my moonshot 30 years ago. Longevity is my moonshot today.
Which technologies, Peter, are you most specifically excited about that you think really move the needle?
Yeah. So, I mean, first off, we have to realize that we now have the ability to sequence and then edit your genome. So obviously, genome sequencing, when Craig Venter sequenced his genome in 2001, it was $100 million in 9 months. Today, it's on the order of a couple hundred dollars and 7 hours. But then the ability to use CRISPR or any of the other gene editing to go in there and, you know, change nucleotides to not accept what you were given. But, you know, it's going from evolution by natural selection, Darwinism, to evolution by human direction. You know, lots of ethical issues. We can talk about those for a month straight. But it's then in gene therapies, being able to inject specific genes, additional copies of certain genes that are beneficial. But then there are things like cellular medicine, right, where we can replenish your stem cell supply, right? We have a large population of stem cells when we're born. And over the course of decades, our stem cell populations come down 100-fold, 1,000-fold in different parts. Augment your natural killer cells, looking for senolytic cells. I mean, there's a number of these. And I'll tell you, the tech I'm excited about is the one we haven't discovered yet. It's what's coming with AI and quantum. And quantum's going to become, we are quantum systems, quantum chemistry, quantum compute, quantum technologies that are literally on our doorstep. Today, Kathy, we just announced a quantum algorithm X Prize jointly with Google, which I'm excited about. We've been announcing, we announced $120 million desalination X Prize last week, a $5 million quantum algorithm prize with Google today. And it's going to be these technologies that help us really understand what the heck is going on in our bodies.
So Peter, one thing I have to back up just a little bit, because I remember when Craig Venter, when he completed the sequence, and I guess Francis Collins, the NIH, was the other, they were racing at the time. Now, maybe we're wrong, but I think we did this arithmetic, and so our clients have heard it many times. But just in case we're wrong, I want to go back. You said $100 million.
The U.S. Government spent billions.
Yeah, $2.7 billion to sequence the first whole human genome, and it took 13 years. Craig Venter.
It was $100 million in 9 months.
Yes. And now we're down to $100 to $200.
Yeah, five times faster than Moore's Law, which is amazing. It's been demonetizing, right? And so we'll be at a point in the near future where every baby born will be sequenced. You walk into the hospital, you're sequenced. Why? Because they want to know how you'll metabolize a particular drug before you go under surgery or before you take a medication, right? Because everybody reacts to drugs differently.
Or how epigenetics has impacted your genome, you know,
A fun thing, Kathy, is that people go, huh. So I say, okay, you get 2.3 billion letters from your mom. Sorry, 3.2 letters, 3.2 billion from your mom and from your dad. And you have the same genome when you're born, when you're 20, when you're 50, when you're 80, when you're 120. So why do you look different, right? Why don't you have a six pack when you're 80? And it's not the software you're running. It is the epigenome. It's which genes are on and which genes are off. And so we're discovering that, right? A lot of the work that's being done by David Sinclair and George Church and others are beginning to say, well, can we reset your epigenome back to a more youthful state? And so far, you know, Charlie, correct me if I'm wrong here, but so far the evidence looks like, yes, we can manipulate your epigenome.
Yeah. And look, I think there's some really interesting work has come here from things like twin studies, where twins separated at birth obviously have the same genome, but they can diverge as much as up to about 10 years by the sort of the sixth, seventh, eighth decade of life in their actual age, in terms of true biological age, whether that's measured by time to death, which is obviously ultimately the biological age, or with some of the clocks, like the Horvath clock out of UCLA, that shows you pretty accurately what the biological age is by using this epigenetic clock with these differentially methylated genes up and down across the genome. And I think that's a great segue, actually, Peter, into one of the technologies. I'd be very interested in your take on this whole space, but that's obviously been coming more emergent in the last few years with a few big funding splashes is around the whole Yamanaka factor, or that extended way of potentially modulating the epigenome. And obviously, for listeners, the Yamanaka got the Nobel Prize in 2012 for identifying the four transcription factors which could drive any cell essentially to becoming an induced pluripotent stem cell, iPSC. And now you've got a few interesting companies, like, I guess, Altos Labs is very well known, backed by Yuri Milner, I think, and Jeff Bezos. And then you've got New Limit, which is smaller.
Brian's company.
Exactly, Brian Armstrong. And several, I think there are now more than a handful of other companies going along that same sort of pathway. And I think looking for something akin to the Yamanaka factors. Obviously, you can't use all the Yamanaka factors because some of them potentially put you down a kind of more of an oncogenic route. But yeah, have you come across, or have you got interest in that space, Peter? Or do you think
a huge amount. So, I mean, you know, David Sinclair published some work on the cover of like Nature and Science. I mean, some incredible work, right? It was a 13-year summary of where he was able to accelerate the aging of mice and then reverse the aging by giving them three out of the four Yamanaka factors and removing the oncogenic transcription factor, and was able to reverse aging in the retina and optical nerve. Now, what's interesting, you know, that's in a mouse, and you know, we all read about all of these amazing longevity stuff going on in mice. We'd expect mice to be living 500 years by now. But what's more interesting is one of his companies has moved the work into primates, which is, of course, one step much closer to us. And then you're using gene therapies to deliver these factors. And a lot of people are concerned that gene therapies are expensive, and is longevity going to be a rich person's option? Two things worth noting. One is a conversation with George Church, and he said, you know, listen, if you're giving a gene therapy for a rare disease, it can be $500,000 to $2 million per therapy. And because the number of clients, number of patients is small, it's a rare disease. But if you look at the RNA vaccines that we had from Pfizer and Moderna, those were gene therapies effectively. And they cost, you know, single dollars to manufacture per dose because we manufactured them in the hundreds of millions or billions. So gene therapies can be cheap. The other thing that's going on is David Sinclair has been speaking about publicly a cocktail of molecules, not gene therapies, that he believes can reverse epigenetic age. Anyway, it's the biggest market in the world. More capital is flowing to this every year. People have figured out you can't take it with you. So,
yeah. So I do have another question. And as you say, a lot of capital is flowing toward this space, certainly in the private markets. But capital in the public markets has been treated very badly in this space. This,
awful.
I mean, it's astonishing. It's the multiomic space broadly has been our worst performing space. And we've been, our strategies have performed better than the, certainly last year, than the healthcare space. So the market's starting to differentiate, but boy, when we go into a risk off phase in the market where, you know, there's some reticence out there, any companies that are investing heavily in this space are torched. And I just wonder, you know, I have to remind my own team, since I've been through so many of these cycles, that you're going to go through cycles, and there'll be more risk on cycles, for example, where you would think nothing but this space is working. So I need to reassure our client base generally and investors generally that it has not always been this way. This is very unusual. But what is fascinating is we're on the threshold of all of these breakthroughs. They are happening. They are happening. This is not, you know, dreaming 5 to 10 years out. It's now. And so when do you think, and maybe I'll ask both of you this, but when do you think we'll see that aha moment? Just to give you a sense of how bad the mood had been, when I think her name was Allison or Allie, the young girl in the UK who was cured of leukemia after 6 months with, you know, Alyssa. Base editing, right?
Alyssa, exactly. Yeah,
yes, right. Alyssa, you know, it didn't even make any waves. This was late 22. Last year, we got the first approvals for gene editing for beta thalassemia and sickle cell disease, both U.S. and
which is amazing. This is like miraculous, godlike, right?
And those stocks are starting to respond, but. If you really map out over a 5 to 10 year period, what is likely to happen to those stocks? You know, there are next Genentechs, which started the boom of the biotech revolution in the 80s and which caused huge increases in returns to R&D investing. I'm wondering if this $2 million treatment conversation for rare diseases has just become a showstopper. Investors are saying, they'll never be reimbursed for that. Or what's going on?
I am personally on the board of two of those public companies that got hammered, Celularity and Vaccinity. And, you know, everybody's been slashed by 10-fold, 20-fold. It's insane. At the end of the day, I think what is going on is the market is solely responding to profits and revenues. And a lot of biotech, as you know, is went public on the come. It went public on future potential revenues and future potential profits. And the market that's gone out of phase. As you said, these are just cycles. But these companies are, you know, these companies that have been hit so hard, I mean, ridiculously hard, are going to deliver on revenues and profits. And I think that we're in the most extraordinary biotech buying opportunity on the marketplace right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Charlie, anything you'd like to add?
No, I think I would echo those thoughts. I mean, I think with a lot of these things, the actual change is kind of later but greater, right? People often expect a sort of slightly sublinear curve, and the reality is it's much more like this, and it's nearly a vertical takeoff when it starts to really turn and happen. And I think, you know,
I mean, look at Moderna, right, as an example, what it did. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then we're seeing it with obviously the GLP-1s and things as well, when these things do start just delivering and being used at real scale. And sometimes you see these sort of second order benefits coming through, as we're seeing with the GLP-1s as well. And I think to Peter's point, we're going to have an unprecedented, the fusion, and maybe we'll talk about AI in a minute, of AI plus sequencing plus other analogous to sequencing, but single cell, much improved proteomics, all of these things start to give us a much greater insight into causal biology, because that's been the huge missing piece in the history of all of healthcare. Mm-hmm.
Kathy, I was going to say, one of the companies I built recently with Tony Robbins is called Fountain Life. And we built centers. We've got four centers we built. We have a runway to build out 30 centers around the world. And these are the most advanced diagnostics and therapeutic centers. You go and you're uploaded. We digitize you 150 gigabytes of data, full body MRI, brain vasculature, coronary CT with AI, 120 biomarkers, metabolomics, microbiome, genomics, everything. To answer two questions, is there anything going on in your body you should know about? Right? I ask people all the time, like an audience, is anybody here know that they're perfectly well? There's nothing going on in your body? And of course, no one raises their hand because you have no idea. You know, the body's amazingly good at hiding disease. Mm-hmm. I'll give you the numbers in a second, but the second question we ask is, if there's nothing going on, great. What's likely to get you? Because you can make those predictions. And how do you stop it or slow it down? And what we find is 2% of people going through have a cancer right now they don't know about. 2.5% have an aneurysm they don't know about. 14.4% have either neurocognitive, metabolic, cardiovascular disease. And the body is just amazingly good at compensating.
What age range are you talking about?
Are the people going through the centers are typically 30 to 80. Those numbers are for people typically in their 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And before we started the podcast, I love the way you summarized what's going to happen, just to wrap up healthcare in a sense, to the diagnostic and surgery spaces.
Yeah. So my view here is diagnostics and surgical therapeutics to solve a problem, right? Are both going to massively demonetize and democratize. The best diagnosticians will be your AI, right? We're all going to be having wearables, insidables, implantables, consumables that are measuring everything in our body. It'll be relatively cheap, uploading the data to your AI, my Aura ring, my CG, my continuous glucose monitor, and so forth. And it won't be going in quarterly like we do right now, but every day, catching stuff at the very beginning. But the interesting thing is what happens in surgery, and I have a number of my family members are surgeons. I goad them with this all the time. I said, you know, the best surgeons in the world are going to be robots. Why? Because, first of all, do you know the question you ask if you're interviewing a surgeon? What's the number one thing you ask a surgeon if you have to do a surgery of some type?
How many times have you done this?
It is exactly that. I would add, how many times did you do it this morning? So the surgeon who has done the most cases of that surgery and has seen the most variations is the most skilled. But here's what's going to go on, right? A surgeon may see, you know, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 cases during their career. But imagine a AI robotic platform that there are thousands of robots all sharing the same information, just like a Tesla car. When an upload occurs, they all get it. So a particular malformation seen by one robot is now known by all the surgical robots, mm-hmm. right? And there's no, the robot didn't have too much coffee or didn't have a fight with their boyfriend or girlfriend last night, you know, didn't get too little sleep. It can see in infrared or ultraviolet. There's no jitter. And what is the cost of that surgery? It's the CapEx of the robot, the cost of electricity, and that's it.
Yeah, you know, okay, so this is a beautiful segue into robotics and AI, actually. And, you know, just trying to figure out, you know, with Elon Musk and Optimus and, you know, the possibilities here, how essential, we're trying to figure out what is coming first, the human advances in AI or advances in, you know, robot technology, or they're happening at the same time, you know, is this another convergence? We're seeing the physical and the digital world come together in profound ways. And is that what's happening effectively?
Yeah. I've been building robots since high school. Built my first robot in ninth grade, and I've been building them ever since, not in the last 20 years, but throughout college and grad school. And, you can see some advances in material sciences, in artificial muscle materials and sensors and better batteries and better imaging and so forth. But 99% of the advances now are all AI. It's the ability for the robot's a sensor suite and an actuator suite, and the ability for that robot to parse the information and make the proper movements is all sitting on top of GPUs. Our robots have gotten brains, and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. You know, I was talking to Brett Adcock from Figure, all right, my venture fund's an investor there, and he was showing me, and they just got like a large, you know, like $700 million or thereabouts from a number of investors to move it forward, and he was showing me how they had Figure, which is the name of their robot and the name of their company, watch a person making a cup of coffee in Keurig and watching them 30 times, just repeat, repeat, repeat. And in a multimodal mode, it was able then to parse it into understanding the parts, the steps, and the motions required. And then it did it perfectly.
Yeah, we saw that video. It is available out there. I would suggest anybody go look at it to see, you know, how the fingers are now operating and yeah. So precisely. It's really marvelous.
It's going to be, I think it's, so listen, I live in Santa Monica. It's where I'm broadcasting from. And we have these little six-wheeled robots that are running around the streets and are delivering food, right? And a local shop puts it in and it runs down and you can order it that way. And the first time you see it, it's like, oh, wow, that's cool. I wonder how it's crossing the street. And you're super enticed. And then after you've seen it 100 times, it's like, get out of the damn way.
It's true. It's
so true. I think that's going to happen with our humanoid robots too.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Yeah, we humans get used to stuff so fast.
Right. So when you say that, what are you saying? I mean, they're going to be able to do things much better than human beings can if they're repetitive and, you know, involve a lot of precision and so forth, right? So we'll be happy about that. They'll be taking all of these jobs that nobody really wants to do.
The term is called the jobs that are dull, dangerous, or dirty is when I think about them. But, you know, I know that my niece and my brother-in-law who are surgeons both like being surgeons, and I think they'd want to stay being surgeons, not have the robot take their surgery job. So there will be that going on. I'm just thinking about the first time we start to see humanoid robots walking down the street, walking the dog, or making package deliveries. I mean, that's going to be fascinating. What have you heard, Kathy, as the projection on the number of robots we're going to see out there in the real world?
Well, We are. Do you know how low the base is right now of robots? I think there are. Well, Amazon, for the first year, it doubled its robots to roughly 1 million last year, and cut employment for the very first time by maybe 100,000. And we think this year the number of robots will pass the number of employees at Amazon. So, and they've been very progressive on this front. But if you look at the industrial robot space out there, it's at a very low base. And if Amazon is any example, we're going to be shocked at how many robots are going to be doing. Now, they're not going to be humanoid robots. Some will be just pick and place, you know, So, it depends what you mean by that. But we're trying to size that opportunity ourselves. And you know, robots, if you think about it, autonomous vehicles are robots, and we're still trying to get those to work. That Tesla has 5 or 6 million of them out in the world, right? I have two of them, a Model 3 and a Model Y. So I think we're going to turn around and kind of say, oh, okay, that was the evolution towards robotics, that vehicle, which begs another question. We're still trying to get autonomous taxis, robo-taxis, really working at scale. And of course, Elon famously, and in his last quarterly call, it was very interesting. He did not make a prediction, but I think since 2016, he's been making a prediction that it would be within a year or two. Now that he's not making the prediction, maybe it will, it's about to happen. Who knows? Because slowly, 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 then all at once. That's, yes, as you know very well, the history of technology. But it is taking so long to get a fully scaled autonomous platform. I mean, we expected it initially in 22. Now we're saying late this year, next year. And we do see Tesla starting to gear up from its job postings. But, you know, his landing on the bus?
Slowly, slowly, and all at once. That's a great title for a book.
Yeah.
You know, the number I heard from Brett, and I think from Vinod Khosla, was as many as 10 billion by 2040, like as many humanoid robots as humans.
Yes,
which
makes
sense. Which is amazing, right? I think about how many cars there are in the world, and I had to Google that the other day, and it's under 1 billion cars, which surprised me.
Yeah.
So more robots, which is why Tesla is saying, you know, this is a much bigger opportunity for us.
Yes.
Than cars.
It'll be interesting to see as well. I think there are a lot of folks at the moment are sort of thinking, what does the future look like where everyone has an AI, not necessarily a digital twin, although maybe that too, but an AI that is their coach and their counselor and their friend and just their helper. And whether that ends up becoming embodied in their robot that's paired with them, or whether it's a separate thing, or whether we have a whole dinner table of different AIs. I know folks like Mustafa Suleiman, who wrote The Coming Wave. He's got this thought with Inflection.
I mean, I'm convinced we are all going to have a version of Jarvis, right? We're going to have, and Jarvis is my favorite AI model, because I believe, in fact, we're going to have, and Jarvis will be our interface to the world. Whatever you need done, you speak to Jarvis. It can, if you're sitting in an F-35 jet, Jarvis, please taxi and take off and fly to 10,000 feet. It knows how to interface. It's got the ultimate API library, if you would. Mm-hmm. But what's really going to be interesting, you know, I love playing convergence on Elon's companies, is Neuralink and Optimus.
Right.
So I want to plug my visual, auditory, and muscle in my, you know, homunculus, my sensory and motor cortex through Neuralink into a robot. That's going to be very doable. And I can walk down the streets of Tokyo from Santa Monica on the other side of the planet. Maybe the speed of light's going to screw that up a little bit. Okay.
Anyway. Details.
What about the three-way convergence, Peter, with Neuralink, Optimus, and the X platform, and just having all those trillions of tweets into your brain at the same time?
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, you mentioned, uh, I I get it. And Kathy, you mentioned Ray Kurzweil, who has been a dear mentor and co-founder and partner. We've started a couple of companies together. And, you know, he made the prediction of AGI, whatever AGI means, by 2029. And people used to laugh at him. And now they're, you know, they're pretty sold that it's in that window. But he also made the prediction of high bandwidth brain computer interface by 2033.
Yeah, no, I am fascinated because in 2019, if you take a look, this was 2019, a long time after Ray made that prediction. But 2019, if you look at the forecasts of futurists or people who claim to be futurists, the time to AGI in 2019 was 80 years.
Mm-hmm.
Today, on average, it's 8 years, you know, after the massive GPT breakthroughs. How did Ray get that right? Because even we were pushing the envelope, we thought, we were, you know, much sooner than 80 years, but how did Ray nail that? What was that? I mean, I read his book, but I just cannot remember. I probably wasn't taking it as seriously then, but
I think it's his time machine that allowed him to do that. So, I mean, so what Ray is doing is looking at, I mean, exponential curves are very predictable. And he's looking at the number of neuronal connections in the human brain, right? We have 100 billion neurons, 100 trillion synaptic connections. And he's estimating if you were going to model a synaptic connection by virtue of a unit of compute, how quickly that was moving. And that's about an answer I can give you from my memory, but those are his projections. And he just said 2029. Now, he made that prediction in 1999.
I know. And I'm telling you, in 2019, the futurists were saying 80 years from now, and now they're all walking it back and saying, basically, he was right. Now, what does that mean? What is life going to be like then, Peter?
Well, in post AGI or post brain computer interface? So here's a question for you, right? So there's something very interesting happened that no one's talking about, which is we basically just blasted through the passing of the Turing test without even noticing. I mean, no one said, ta-da, we did it, or look at what just happened, and so forth. It's like, it's in the rearview mirror, right? No one argues that the Turing test, as originally designed and expressed, has been passed a long time ago, right?
For people who don't know, maybe you just restate what that is.
Yeah, so Alan Turing wrote a paper that said, when will we know that we have artificial intelligence? And he said, if you could be sitting at a teletype and typing at something, either a human or an AI, and having a conversation by text, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and you can't tell whether it is a human or a machine typing at you, because you ask it whatever question, how you're feeling today, what you have for breakfast, and it's answering in a way, then if you can't tell, then there's no difference between that human and that AI, and that's become known as the Turing test. And of course, today, not only can we type it at these things, I have on my Moonshot podcast, I've done a number of I did a podcast with a Peterbot, a virtualized version of me, and with a few other AIs, where the conversation is shockingly real. And in fact, Peterbot's better than I am in the conversations. And I'm like, I'm jealous. And so we passed an extraordinary version of the Turing test. So the question is, when we get to AGI, artificial general intelligence, which is yet kind of undefined, I've never heard a really good definition other than human level intellect. But a lot of AIs today are much better than humans at so many different things. I guess a generalized intelligence, like it can drive your car, and it can fold your clothes, and it can do your homework.
And it can take the GRE or the SAT and get and pass it, or doctors or lawyers.
Yeah.
I think the other definition is it can put together a model car in you know, one that is almost impossible for a human being to. And as you say, with the Turing test, you know, you're now talking for 2 hours and you have no idea whether you're talking to a human or a robot. That sort of.
And so it's able to do everything, which, by the way, no human can do, right? Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, it isn't really AGI. It's digital superintelligence, because it's beyond any single human. It's you're asking it now, if it can do all those things, you probably have to have a collection of 1,000 experts to be able to do all those things. And you're just saying AGI. So that's, I call BS on that. But
yeah.
So what's going to happen? You know, Sam Altman famously said people are going to be freaked out for about, you know, 3 days, and then they'll go back to normal. So, but the interesting thing is going to be when do we see new companies and new breakthroughs? So what I'm excited about is physics and medicine and chemistry and biology insights that no human has been able to parse. And all of a sudden, new materials are being invented, new understandings of why and how we age, or new, you know, unified field theories, and things are coming out of like, oh my God, that's amazing. That will be exciting, right, for me.
And a lot of the, interestingly, as you say, getting a core understanding of actual physics is has not been something demonstrated yet, but is, you know, considered a next frontier. But even as basic planning is something that the AIs to date have not. This is probably the coming year or two of these agentic systems that can really form a future state plan of the world and then work towards that. And I think that's going to be some of the most exciting things we see in AI probably in the coming 1 to 2 years.
For us, you know, listen, I'm on my 25th company, and I love starting companies. And it's going to be a lot of fun to be able to brainstorm with an AI and start companies. And, you know, they're going to be the predictions of the first unicorns that are built with, you know, a girl, a dog, and an AI come together and form a company. And I was thinking about one thing the other day, and I mentioned it in my podcast. I wonder which country will be the first country to allow an AI to incorporate in its nation on its own. Because I think
that will be interesting.
So I think what happens then is all the AIs incorporate their startups in that country. And just the country has to tax those AI startups. I think I think for the right nation, that's a big idea.
You know where that is starting to happen? It is not quite like that, but El Salvador, it's focused on
Bitcoin,
two things, AI, well, both Bitcoin and AI. It's attracting AI talent down tax-free and so forth. So yeah, we're definitely keeping our eye on that. One question though on AI, big debate out there. You actually have a phrase for it, boomer or doomer?
Yeah. So I just finished I have a big event every year called the Abundance Summit. It's Singularity University's highest level event, and I run it year round. It's 500. You were there at the Abundance Summit.
It's amazing. It's amazing. The energy level there, people from all around the world. It's amazing.
Yeah. Our theme next year is convergence, and you're going to be joining me there. I'm excited about that.
Looking forward to that.
The past year, just now, the theme was the AI Great Debate. And so we brought together Ray Kurzweil and Jeffrey Hinton and Eric Schmidt and Guillaume Verdun and got a whole bunch of folks, I'm forgetting, Imad Mustaq. And we were debating and discussing, are you a boomer? We need to go as fast as possible. AI is the single most important thing that humanity is going to need to solve problems and to solve actually white hat, black hat, you know, issues. Or are you a doomer, which is like, slow down. We don't understand it. We got to slow down. And one of the comments made by a gentleman, Alexander Wiesner-Gross, was he said, okay, that's one dimension to look at this, which is boomer versus doomer, but it's missing a dimension that's very important, which he said is the dimension is coupled versus uncoupled. What does that mean? He said, are we coupling the future of AI with the future of humanity? Or is AI going to take off and leave us behind? Right? So this is the movie Her, right? Where AIs say, bye, we're kind of bored here. And so the coupling would occur on the back end of brain-computer interface, Neuralink. There's a whole number of amazing BCI companies. I just had two brain-computer interface companies presenting at the Abundance 360 summit this year. So I think, you know, all of this is happening like right now, Kathy. This is the most exciting time to be alive.
Oh man, I mean, and what is so interesting and being in the equity markets and watching the fear of change. I mean, there's we already talked about the multiomic space, but you know, there are a few stocks, the Mag 6, they've taken Tesla away, and I'm kind of happy about that. I don't want to be in the Mag anything, you know, meaning Mag 6, you know, I think they're, you know, I think Google could be disrupted, you know, and so Apple could be disrupted, you know, AI, we've been watching Apple on AI for a long time, really trying to figure out
when
and would it finally debut its AI stripes with an autonomous vehicle, the ultimate mobile device.
But they shut it down, right?
And they've just shut it down. So, you know, it's really interesting to see this pass them by in a sense, but, you know, I don't want to write them off that when, you know, when Steve Jobs was around, many people wrote it off as a cell phone player. And of course, it redefined the space. Now, Steve Jobs is no longer with us, so we shall see what happens. But
I mean, I would never bet against Elon. I think Tesla has got massive headspace, and I believe
absolutely
exactly as you do with AI, with robotaxis, and with Optimus, and with everything going on there. Apple, I have to, you know, listen. Apple has got to be. I mean, they're the most secretive company on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've
got a world
got,
that is valuing transparency and open source much more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they have to be, you know, I'm assuming iPhone 16 or 17 will debut a version of Siri that can finally spell Kathy correctly when I text you, you know, instead of the five other ways. It's like, listen, her name is right there in the two line. Would you please notice where that is?
Is that why you don't spell my name correctly? I'm kidding.
But you said, you mentioned something which is interesting, that most people fear the future.
Yeah, they do. And especially if a company's willing to invest in it, they really hate that. And guess what? It's not going to happen unless they invest aggressively. And they need to invest aggressively now in order to win in this new world.
You know, that is the reason I started my Abundance 360 membership and summit 12 years ago, it's my 12th year now, was a conversation I had with a gentleman, Dan Sullivan, where he said, people fear the future, Peter, and you don't. And he said, you need to show people why they should be excited about the future, right? And so for me, these converging technologies uplift humanity.
Absolutely.
They are enabling us to have access to all the food, water, energy, healthcare, education, everything, and making the world a better place. And I think we should be excited about the future. It's the most exciting time ever to be alive.
Yeah. And, you know, what I see in the public world, public asset management, is really a reliance on the past. They're quite happy to be in the Mag 6. And, you know, NVIDIA has, you know, all praises to Jensen Huang. He saw the future well before a lot of others and deserves to be there. But I do think that even with NVIDIA, the competition, now that the aha moment has taken place, you do, of course, have AMD, but you've got the hyperscalers, the cloud companies developing, each of them their own chips. You've got Tesla with its own chip. So I think this idea that NVIDIA
don't discount Intel.
Intel is absolutely working in this direction. Cerberus is, you know, a chip company, very focused here as well. So, and China, very interestingly.
Yeah,
China, you know, as someone, I was speaking to someone at the IMF last week, and I was trying to noodling through with them, you know, China, what's going to happen here? How does it change the subject from its property implosion and debt, you know, overwhelming debt to something else? Well, there, hopefully it's not Taiwan. Hopefully it is innovation. And he said, oh, you mean like when in the 70s and 80s, we banned Japan. Or not, we didn't ban. We put sanctions on Japan autos because they were, you know, they were basically dumping cheap autos in the U.S. And so what did Japan do? It changed the subject. It actually developed some of the most sophisticated and high quality automobiles in the world. And I just wonder if this is going to happen with China and chips. Our analysts would suggest it will be difficult because ASML is the gating factor, and ASML is not selling its equipment to China. But we shall see. Very interesting.
China has an extraordinary number of scientists and technologists, and they have a very focused national will.
Yes.
They have the ability to mobilize capital, rewrite regulations, mobilize scientists and technologists, and say, and do their own Manhattan projects. So I would not ever count against them. And a friend of mine who's CEO of one of the large current language, large language model AI companies, his statement to me was that the LLMs coming out of China have surpassed the US at this point.
Yeah, we've seen a few. One was called Qi, I think. Open source, interestingly. And on our open source performance line, so we've been mapping out closed source performance increases of large language models and open source large language models, their performance increase. And what we've seen is while open source is still below performance, its slope, its rate of increase is faster. Interestingly, we got Claude 3 out, its performance, and it out has it has finally topped GPT-4, and that's the first time we've seen that. So that's interesting. One last topic. Peter,
I was going to inject one topic there, if I may, which is we didn't, you know, when you were on my Moonshots podcast, we didn't talk about Sora.
Right.
And Sora's come out, and when I saw that the first day, my tweet was, you know, Hollywood, rest in peace. Right. I mean, honestly,
brand is shifting.
Yeah, it truly is. And we're going to reinvent in the entertainment marketplace.
Yes.
And we're also, the biggest challenge, of course, is we're going to start to reinvent what truth means. You know, we're going to go from seeing as believing, which is what we have all of humanity, to, I think, defaulting to distrust.
Yes. Already see that with young people. Is this a fake?
Yeah. First reaction.
Yeah. So very interesting. Last topic, very timely. Bitcoin has become all the rage. I just talked about people being fearful of the future. Well, they were right after FTX, but that would have been a great place to buy.
Buy
when there's blood in the street. And so here we are up close to 70,000. What do you think?
I've been buying. I remember when you were on my stage at the Abundance 360 2 years ago. Yeah, and you were saying within the 5 years we'll get to a million, and we're on that trajectory. So I'm a huge Bitcoin proponent. I just had Michael Saylor on stage with me. Right, he's one of the largest Bitcoin maximalists.
Evangelist.
And in the most beautiful way, he communicates it, right? And it's really the financial layer on the internet. It is a equalizing, abundance-enabling force on humanity. So, I mean, I talk about the six Ds of exponential. Whenever you digitize something, in the beginning, it's deceptive, and then it becomes disruptive, and it dematerializes, demonetizes, and democratizes. And that's Bitcoin to the financial industry.
Yeah.
And you've been saying that forever.
Exactly as you say, Peter. This is the financial superhighway. And the most important thing to us is that anyone can gain exposure to it, because it is revolutionary. We call it a monetary revolution, a financial services revolution, and a new asset class, which is, we haven't had a truly new asset class since the 1600s, equities.
What was that?
Equities in the 1600s. Yeah, I mean, people call ARC a new asset class, which is, think about how crazy that is. We're just investing in the future. Isn't that what investing is supposed to be?
Yes, it is. And I love that. And you know, we haven't. So it's interesting, right? We've started now. Institutions have started to buy in, and governments are just putting their toes in the water.
Yes,
it's already irreversible, and governments will come in, but we haven't even started talking about Bitcoin applications, mm-hmm. right? The use of Bitcoin as a financial layer. And when it starts being pulled into every part of our lives, and it's a backbone that's, you know, that we don't see, but it's being used.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
What a great time.
What a time to be alive. And I could talk to you all day long, Peter. Thank you so much. Charlie had to leave, but we both thank you so much.
This my pleasure.
Is enjoyable, and looking forward to many more of these conversations. I think we'll have a lot of them, because so much is going to change so quickly. I think heads are going to spin.
Let's do it on a regular basis. I'd love like a quarterly catch up together.
That would be very cool. That would be wonderful. We would love that.
Take care, Kathy.
Okay, Peter. All right. Take care now. Bye-bye now.
Thank you.
Bye. ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.